In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is The Guardian.
The instability we see in our region, the developments in the Ukraine, hopefully will play into the minds of voters as they go to the ballot box at the next election, where they don't want to end up with a hung parliament, with a dozen crossbenchers, which makes decision-making that much more difficult at a time when decision-making becomes that much more important.
Hello, lovely podders. Welcome to the show. You're with Catherine Murphy, and this is Australian Politics. We are in the final week of the current parliament. It's kind of amazing to think that, but I'm recording Thursday. It literally is the last day. It's hectic. People around the building are preparing for the coming campaign, and some parliamentarians are bowing out of public life. They're heading into new careers or to retirement because there is this sense of a moment in time, something ending. I thought what I would do this week is ask the Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, to front the show. He's had a very busy week with the budget, obviously. Josh, welcome to the program.
Well, g'day, Catherine. Nice to be with you and your listeners.
So, Josh, you've had a hell of a journey, really, from the end of the Turnbull period. Scott Morrison assumed the leadership, and then you've been through this past term, which has been enormously heavy in all kinds of ways, with events and having to respond to, well, the biggest public health crisis, obviously, since the Spanish flu. So if we sort of take that as a span of time, Josh, from the neg and the sort of crash out of the neg to now, to today, what, you know, Dickens spoke famously of the best of times and the worst of times. So what were the best and what were the worst?
It's been a tumultuous period, to say the least. It's also fair to say that I didn't have high expectations going into the last election. I thought, but, you know, we'd give it our best shot when I saw that we got a bit of a lift post-budget in 2019, I had some dreams of getting over the line, but I certainly didn't think that that was a certainty. And it turned out to be the result we wanted, and we were given another opportunity. And so that was pretty pleasing, and that was also pretty tumultuous. And then the budget was postponed as we obviously had the COVID pandemic in 2020. And from there, it's been just a sprint for 2 years responding to the most difficult and challenging health and economic environment. In terms of the worst of times, it was those early days in March and April 2020 when literally 1.4 million Australians lost their jobs or saw their working hours go down to zero. The images of our fellow Australians lining up outside Centrelink having lost their jobs were for many reminiscent of scenes of the Great Depression. Speaking to lots of small business owners who saw their doors closed and were fearful of losing their life savings, there was just fear right across the community. And obviously we responded with JobKeeper and other programs, some 1,000 plus decisions that we took. The best feeling was obviously the trajectory that then occurred with the economy coming back. We were in and out of lockdown in Victoria, which also took a toll on so many of us at a human level. You know, not being able to see our family, not being able to see our friends, having our kids out of the classroom. So that was a pretty low point as well. And I felt, you know, at sometimes helpless because it's the state government that is making the determinations about who is in school and how far you can travel from your home and, you know, whether you're in fact, you know, allowed to open your business again. But the best feeling is to see where the unemployment rate is today and to know that we have avoided the experience of earlier recessions in Australia, particularly the 80s and the 90s, where the unemployment rate was elevated for so long and it took, you know, 10 years for many to get back to work. And that has not happened this time.
Mm. What about sharing with people how you've, it's sort of a silly way to put it, like how have you kept yourself together? But I really mean it, I suppose, at that human level, right? There's been a lot to do, a lot of decisions to make, particularly in the beginning when governments around the world were literally making it up as they went along in terms of what was the best way to respond. Tell us a little bit about your habits over this period, because obviously you had to keep yourself well, you had to keep yourself connected, you had to buy some thinking time. You know, look, when Greg Combe left the parliament several years ago, I did a really interesting exit interview with him in which he was talking about the intensity of being a cabinet minister and how little time and space you get to process these really epic decisions. So what sort of habits and rituals do you maintain in order to allow yourself to do that, to make these decisions?
There were sort of two that were non-negotiable for me. The first was obviously getting up in the morning and jumping on the stationary exercise bike. And whether you had 3 hours sleep or 5 or 6, it still was the means by which I started my day. And that helped because particularly when you're doing lots of media earlier in the morning and you haven't had much sleep, that is a means to wake up as well as obviously to stay healthy. So regular exercise was really important. There were plenty of hamburgers and chips and lollies in between, but regular exercise was, and lots of coffee, I have to, dare I say it, but regular exercise was one. The other one was obviously staying closely connected with my family, who meant everything to me, and being away from home is hard, and lots of people in lots of different professions and vocations are away from home, so I'm no different, but it was really important to have the FaceTime with my kids a couple of times a day in the morning, particularly interrupting Bluey and before they went off to school, and then in the evening before dinner. And, you know, when I did get home, having the opportunity to read them a story at night was really important. So my family always keep me grounded. They always remind me of what is the most important thing in my life. Politics comes and goes, elections come and go, budgets come and go, but your family is always there with you.
And it might sound like I'm asking you the first question again in a different form, but it's not my intention. I just want you to focus on, if you had to identify over this period one thing that you're most proud of, just only one, pick one, and one thing that, if you're being honest, you regret?
Well, the thing that I regret, but I'm not sure I could have changed, is the fact that the kids were out of school in Melbourne for so long. I think that was a terrible injustice. I think it's going to have long-term consequences. I had a local GP in my electorate contact me and say that they were providing antidepressants to kids as young as 12 during the lockdown. And they actually joined as a series of GPs to write an open letter to the Premier about what they were seeing happen to kids' mental health. So I know that, you know, COVID is a deadly virus and, you know, this was the earlier strains as opposed to the Omicron strain. And there was also the pre-vaccine period as well. But I just feel I wish I could have done more on that. Yeah, I wish I tried to do more perhaps, but I don't, you know, I did speak out. And I don't regret that, by the way, Catherine. Speaking out, I was criticised by some across the political divide for doing so, but the people who felt the way I did needed to have a voice, and that's why I said what I said, and I'm actually very proud of what I said when I look back at that speech in the Parliament that I gave when the Labor Party brought on a spontaneous suspension of the Parliament in order to debate Victoria. In terms of what I'm proudest of, I mean, I am pretty proud of JobKeeper, I must say. I think, you know, for a Liberal Party, it's certainly not something we'd expected to be announcing during a, a pandemic or otherwise, an economy-wide wage subsidy at a cost of $90 billion at a flat $1,500 a fortnight. And to get that out super quickly through the tax system and to get it out with integrity as well, and that it was delivered not to dead people, it was delivered to workers right around the country, and to know that the economy bounced back very strongly with the connection between employers and employees, which is not a given, because if you look at the United States, there are more than 2 million fewer Americans in work today than there were at the start of the pandemic, whereas in Australia, there's 375,000 more people in work today than the start of the pandemic. So they're my bookends, I suppose. The terrible time that young people experience being out of the classroom, particularly the most disadvantaged kids, by the way, Catherine, the ones who either are not able to access computer equipment at home or living in a family environment where there's domestic violence or there's no parental supervision, or they don't have English as a first language and may have found it difficult during those times. There's lots of issues, I think, that are a function of kids being out of a classroom, not for a month or two, but literally for a year or more.
Mm. I want to take you to the current political environment, which obviously can't be ignored.
Yeah.
I did a field trip in northern Tasmania last week in Bass and Braddon, and if I were to summarise the mood of voters there, certainly the voters that we spoke to over the week we were there, it would be this sense that the major parties are not delivering. People are quite negative about the Prime Minister. They're not yet, though, convinced that Anthony Albanese is the answer to what they feel is missing in the political space. Now, of particular interest to there, and this is something that's a lived reality for you in your own seat, there was quite a lot of spontaneous interest from people in Bass and Braddon about independence, particularly in that context, the Jackie Lambie network, because Jackie Lambie has very high name recognition. Now, obviously, in Kooyong, you're facing a challenge from an independent as well. I realise you need to be disciplined with your message, and we're about to go into a campaign and you just can't say whatever the hell you think about these things. But as honestly as you can, try and talk to me about that environment. I don't imagine what I've just told you is a surprise to you, right?
Yeah. So the independents are very well funded and well organised and are acting as a political party. In my case, I'm up against a former Labor Party member who sought to hide that background. They're running on the Labor Party platform. They're running with the support of the Labor Party. And what I mean by that is that the Labor Party is running dead in the seats in which these independents are campaigning, and they're running only against Liberals in the city seats.
But obviously in Bass and Braddon, Labor's contesting those two contests, and you're talking about the Teal independents.
Yeah, I'm talking about North Sydney, I'm talking about Boothby, I'm talking about Curtin, I'm talking about Goldstein, I'm talking about Wentworth, and obviously Kooyong.
No. And acknowledging that, but all that is true. They are organised, they are well funded, they're running, perhaps with no disrespect to people, more professional campaigns than they ran in the last election cycle. All that's true. But I want to take you to that point of disenchantment, right? Mm. You can be the most well-funded person in the entire universe. Clive Palmer is a case in point. He spent $18 million or something on advertising in the last federal election, did not get a member up anywhere, right? You can have all the resources, but you don't have any prospect of success unless your issues are salient.
But the inherent difference here, Catherine, is it's a partnership between the independents, the Labor Party and the Greens. So whatever happens in a seat like mine, the Labor Party will poll, above 10 maybe above 15%. The Greens last time polled above 20%. With those parties running dead in the seats in which the Teal candidates are contesting, that is their base effectively, which they just need to build on. They're pinching votes off the Liberal Party and, of course, subsuming the votes of the Labor Party and the Greens. So that is actually what's happening. So it becomes a two-party contest between the independent and the incumbent, who are Liberals. And the dynamic is, as you say, slightly different to last time. Climate change is obviously the most pressing issue on which they are campaigning on. Since our government committed to net zero by 2050 and has laid out a pretty detailed plan with the technology investment roadmap and backed that up with more than $20 billion worth of investment, I think we've got a strong case. But even in a seat like mine, these are not one-issue elections. The election is going to be fought on who can best manage the economy. And, of course, as the Treasurer, I can help direct that outcome. And the budget was our plan, not just to ease the cost of living pressures, but also the long-term economic plan with further investments to generate productivity growth. And with a strong economy, you can list more drugs on the PBS and fund, as we have done in an unprecedented way, disability support, mental health and women's safety, all of which is true. And then, of course, you layer that upon the national security environment in which Australia finds itself in, and the instability we see in our region, the developments in the Ukraine, all of which hopefully will play into the minds of voters as they go to the ballot box at the next election, where they don't want to end up with a hung parliament, where they don't want to end up with a dozen crossbenchers, which makes decision-making that much more difficult at a time when decision-making becomes that much more important.
Well, the stakes are high, it's true, but then you say people don't want to end up with an independent crossbench that sort of complicates the mandate of a parliament to make quick decisions in
tough
times.
Well, we've seen that movie before, right?
No, sure, but I'm going to rebut your point, because the feedback again in Northern Tasmania was that is exactly what people want. So that was really quite interesting to me. So again, I'm inviting you to reflect on why it is that there are voters around who think they are not getting what they want from either major party. I'm not personalising this. Obviously, people are negative about the Prime Minister at this point in time, and I'm not inviting you to reflect on that necessarily. I'm inviting you to reflect on this sentiment that is out there that the major parties are not delivering. Why? What have you done wrong?
Well, firstly, I think with every election, there's a growing cohort of swinging voters. So I always reflect back to what John Howard told me when he first went into politics, that he thought there were 40% of people who always voted Liberal, 40% who always voted Labor, and then there was the 20% in the middle. By the time he left politics, it was 30% who voted Liberal, 30% who voted Labor, and a 40% cohort in the middle. I think that cohort in the middle's getting bigger at every election, to be honest.
Yeah, so why? Why do you think that?
In the current context, there's been huge disruption to people's lives. And I'm obviously talking about COVID, natural disasters, the changing international environment. With new technologies, we've all got a mouthpiece now with our Twitter or our Facebook. And so the conversation's changing. Certainly the means of having that conversation are changing. And in that time, I think the disruption has led to a level of uncertainty about political allegiances as well. And also, people's satisfaction with respect to, individual decisions. And so they could be happy on this thing, but they're increasingly unhappy on that thing. And that means their vote is up for grabs in a way that it wasn't in the previous time. And political parties are seeing declining memberships. Just as we've seen declining memberships of, great institutions like the Rotarians or the RSLs or church groups. And I think there's a changing dynamic which is playing out across society with real political impact.
Yes.
That means there's more swing voters than ever.
I caught the tail end of Kevin Andrews' valedictory this morning. He made quite an interesting point at the end because he referenced that, I mean, in...
Not the Shakespeare.
Before the Shakespeare. No, he sort of expressed it in a way that I wouldn't, sort of through, I guess, a tribal lens. But he was making the point that because there is what some of your sort of right-wingers in your political movement would call wokeism or identity politics or whatever else, right, because there's more of that, His suggestion was that actually the institution of the parliament needed to display more civility rather than more kind of high visibility contrast. I'm interested in what your view is about, you know, we are in these mega trends, right? You are governing in this period of incredible mega trends that are disrupting your own profession at the same time as you're legislating all of these policy things, right? I'm sure, I know you well enough to know that you will have turned your mind to it. So what do you think is the answer for political leaders? Is it more civility?
Well, he did quote John F. Kennedy, which was an interesting person for Kevin at the end of his speech. But
indeed, yes.
The point is a real one, which is civility in public life is not a source of weakness or a sign of weakness. And it's something I always admired about Sir Robert Menzies is that he had good relationships across the political divide. I mean, John Curtin was one, but he also, at a state level before he entered federal politics, had good, strong relationships. And that's something I've certainly sought to have while I've been in this place. So I think you're right. I think the public expect more civility in political life than they probably see. It's always been adversarial, but at the same time, I think they would expect a bit more civility than they see.
Well, it's just interesting too, because in this final week of Parliament, of this Parliament, we've had a debate, certainly in your show, around Labor. There's sort of been, it might sound a bit of a whimsical way of putting it, but there have been these different expressions of grief over the last sort of couple of weeks. The sudden death of Kimberley Kitching obviously sort of sparked a debate. Concetta Fierravanti-Wells obviously kicked off another version of this. I don't intend to get us tangled up in who bullied whom or how legitimate these claims are, but there are these moments from where I sit where politics kind of for a moment is a bit more self-aware about culture and the impact of culture, but then those moments seem to pass. So do you think that political culture at the moment is a big problem, honestly?
I certainly think it needs to be improved. And as you say, the last 3 years have seen some pretty traumatic events in this place, which has been a wake-up call for many. And I'm really pleased that there's been, you know, formal processes that have now given us a roadmap to implement and to improve the way complaints are handled and issues are raised. And so I think that will be hopefully of long-lasting benefit. But the Parliament's no different to other workplaces around the country, I think, as well. And there are lessons here for everyone about how they should treat their fellow members.
But also staff. But it's kind of, it's the conundrum, isn't it? It's sort of like, you know, being a professional boxer, you know, at the end of your career, you say in a certain amount of astonishment, oh my God, someone hit me. You know, it's sort of the argument sort of chases its own tail because, as you say, like politics is meant to be adversarial. Politics is at the root, it is war by other means. That's what it is. So you can't remove the conflict from it. But I don't know how you solve these problems. I mean, I have been wrestling with this for 10 years as a reporter. So I'm not suggesting I've got the answers, but
it's not just across the chamber, it's sometimes on your own side.
Exactly. I mean,
Winston Churchill had that, you know, made that famous comment to a young a member of the House of Commons who he, you know, took into the chamber and he pointed across the chamber and he said, "That's where you think your opponents are, but actually They're sitting right behind
they're
you.
They're sitting behind you. Well, okay. Let's pick up on that. You've given me the full toss, so I'm going to pick up on that. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Sitting here today, this could be the last conversation that you and I have, at least in this format, where you are the treasurer and I'm in my position.
Hopefully you're not going anywhere. I'm not aiming to.
Well, that's the point. There is this real sense, and I don't mean that I know the outcome of the election, because genuinely I don't. I have no idea how this is going to go, and I have a sense that there is a campaign there for either side to win, right? Yeah. But it does, there is this real sense this week of something ending, that something has come to an end. What do you think?
Doesn't feel too dissimilar, to be honest, to other final weeks in the parliament. But we start this election as the underdog, as we did for the last election, and you know all too well that ended very differently to where the political pundits and the polls expected it to. So this time round, we go into a campaign off the back of a budget as we did last time, and the budget sets out our plan, and, you know, I was very pleased to see the reaction to it. And campaigns have their own dynamic. And the thing about our political opponents over the last 3 years is that they have literally been a small target. And that's probably partly because of the pandemic itself and the nature of the discourse over the last few years. And so they're going to go into a campaign where the spotlight will be on them in a way that it hasn't been for the last 3 years, and particularly on the alternative leader. I mean, yes, Scott has, as Prime Minister, has had the blowtorch put on him, and so, you know, people have seen that, but Anthony Albanese hasn't. And so I think there's a really interesting dynamic here that could play out over the course of the weeks of an election to come. I don't know what the result will be. I'll certainly be giving it my best effort as the Treasurer, the Deputy Leader, and, of course, the Member for Kooyong. I don't take anything for granted in my electorate. You know, I've been fortunate to have been elected by them 4 times, and I'll continue to work hard to win their confidence. And nationally, there's different dynamics in different states, and that's as a result of different events as well that have played out.
Just quickly, what do you mean by that?
Well, obviously in Western Australia, borders have been closed for the better part of 2 years, and the Liberal Party lost decisively at a state level. And, you know, we've got a number of retiring members. So there's a dynamic there. Queensland feels stronger for us as a coalition right now. I'm hopeful of picking up another seat in Tasmania, in the seat of Lyons. I feel we've got, you know, terrific people in Bass and Braddon with Bridget and Gavin. South Australia, obviously the state election was, you know, a big win for Labor. I think people will look at it differently. At a federal level, and Boothby's obviously the major seat where attention is on there. In Victoria, I do feel there's a bit of disenchantment with Daniel Andrews, and we're the first to go to the polls, given COVID. But the independents are, as we discussed earlier, launching pretty strong campaigns, and the seat of Chisholm is very marginal, but we've got terrific candidates in Corangamite and Dunkley in particular, which are, you know, Steph Asher in Corangamite is the local mayor of Geelong, and Sian Coombs is a survivor of a real survivor from the TV show in Dunkley. He's got a good chance. And then New South Wales, which is obviously, you know, been challenging with the late pre-selections, but there are seats that we can win there, and hopefully Dave Sharma can hold on in Wentworth and Trent Zimmerman in North Sydney. So when you go around the country like that, I think it will be close, but again, it will depend on how the election plays out. The Northern Territory is particularly prospective for us with the retirement there as well in Lingiari, and, you know, and opportunities for us. The ACT is a more difficult hunting ground for us. But if you look across the country like that, and you think that Labor has to, you know, win, you know, nearly 10 seats, you know, 8-plus seats to govern in a majority, you'd have to say it's going to be close. But we do start as the underdog, and, you know, the budget's been so far well received. So I just recognise there's a job to do. No one's getting ahead of themselves, but no one's walking away from the challenge either.
Well, there's a campaign you need to get ready for. I appreciate you making the time. It's an absolutely frantic week in all kinds of ways. So thank you, Josh, for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thank you to Alison Chan, who's cutting the episode this week. Thank you to Miles Martignoni and the whole audio team who've had a very hectic slog during this budget week, which is always one of the biggest political weeks of the year. So thank you to them. Thank you to you guys for listening. I don't know if we'll be in an election in days or in about a week, but it is very, very close. And obviously, make sure you subscribe to the pod to keep yourself up to date with all the happenings of the campaign. We'll be answering your questions for the duration. It's a big time for us and for the public, so we need to stay in touch.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.